The first foreign country I ever lived in was England. I arrived with my parents on the Queen Mary in 1938, a small American kid, almost 7 years old, uprooted from New York City. I was accustomed to yellow taxicabs, Irish cops with guns, nightsticks and urgent whistles, waffles, corn on the cob. My kind of cars were Fords, Packards, Chryslers, Pontiacs and Buicks. My father Cedric had been born in London when Queen Victoria was still on the throne. My mother Irene came from Kansas City via Chicago, where she met my father in a snowstorm. A year later, I was born in Chicago's Grand Hospital, which had been called the German Hospital, until a U-boat sank the Lusitania in 1915. On the other hand, when the King and Queen of England threatened to visit my native city in the 1930s, the mayor, Big Bill Thompson, made himself popular with the local Irish voters by promising to give King George a punch right in the nose. In New York, my parents drove a modest beige Dodge automobile. But in 1938, when we sailed for England at Shell Oil's bidding, a brand new yellow Buick, oh boy, the fanciest car I could ever wish to have, was loaded onto the Queen Mary with us. We were supposed to be going to England for just 1 year, so that my father could wise up on the intricacies of the international oil business before returning to Rockefeller Center to take up a big new job. We docked in Southampton just as Neville Chamberlain, the Homburg-hatted umbrella man, was making his Virgin flight to Munich to hand over chunks of Czechoslovakia and Britain's honour in exchange for what he told his countrymen would be peace in our time. While my parents looked for somewhere to live, we stayed with my grandparents, Ellis and Amy, in their large Victorian flat at 74 Cromwell Road. My grandfather worked for Raphael Tuck, the greetings card people. I imagined that the firm was so called because he worked for it. In fact, Raphael, often pronounced Raphael, was the first name of the founder of the firm. Ellis had worked long enough for Tux to have a car and a driver, called Theobald. The phrase most commonly on his lips was, "Can't stop," as off to work he went. His wife, Amelia Sophia, had been one of the four beautiful Brenson sisters, regular sirens at the Hammersmith Palais de Danse. Out of humour with her nice husband, my grandmother developed what was diagnosed as angina. She spent most of her days resting, bravely. At weekends she got up in a housecoat and played bridge with my parents, while I watched and learned. To put her in a good humour, my father always took Amy half a pound of Maison Lyons chocolates with violet centres. She did not like Americans. But then who did? My parents found a flat, what I called an apartment, in Highlands Heath, a large new block on Putney Heath. When my grandmother heard of our proposed address, she said, "I don't think I should tell people you live in Putney. Better if you say Roehampton." The Benson sisters had been beautiful enough in the Edwardian era to be courted by all sorts of men. They liked to sit in the lobby of the Grand Hotel Eastbourne and quiz the men who came through the swing doors. When they suspected that a newcomer was a Jew, my great-aunt Minnie would say, "Fish," in that grand operatic voice which once sung for Edward VII. We went to afternoon tea, a ceremony unknown on Central Park West, in Minnie's large brown apartment in Oakwood Court near Holland Park. A maid in lacy white apron and coronet wheeled in a trolley with thin bread and butter, scones in a chafing dish, with appropriate dishes of jam, plain biscuits, and a Dundee cake, one-third of it already sliced. There seemed to be no member of my father's family who was not, like England itself, an antique. Since Cedric, like my mother, was an only child, there was not one cousin of my own age to play with or talk to. I listened to the British with the attentive credulity which the anthropologist Margaret Mead lavished on the Trobriand Islanders. These people were not my people, but there they were with their sonorous voices, their weighty furniture, their hallmarked silver, their laced-up servants, and their assumptions of superiority. My grandmother's maid Winifred took me to Buckingham Palace and recited the rhyme about Christopher Robin's nursemaid, Alice, who was marrying one of the guard. "A soldier's life was terrible hard," said Alice. I learned the word busby and we went back to Cromwell Road on a 74 bus. In New York, we took the subway. I really like the Third Avenue L, but never buses. London's red double-deckers had outside staircases and went to strange-sounding destinations, Hackney Wick and Peckham Rye, Tooting Beck and Boreham Wood. Just the sort of places at the end of the town that Christopher Robin was never to go down to, unless he went down with Alice. There was also the deluxe Green Line, slick single-deckers bound for remote places such as Box Hill, Woking, Three Bridges and Leatherhead. On the far side of Putney Bridge, trolley buses rolled on fat tyres towards Hammersmith, their power drawn down by a parallel pair of upraised claws from a nexus of overhead electric wires. The rarest fun was to ride in a tram in deepest South London, where we went to visit my stamp dealer uncle, Godfrey, the poorest and most generous of the Bensons. He gave me 500 British Empire stamps, all different. The Clapham trams had basketwork seats and uttered a swooping moan as they accelerated past billboards, where it said, "We want Watneys," and "Guinness is good for you," and "Don't be vague, ask for Hague." I never rode in or even saw that yellow Buick, which my father was allowed to ship to England. In keeping with the wish not to stand out among what Cedric always called the Christians, my parents sold their showy trophy and bought a modest standard coupe. It was dark blue and sported a little enamelled Union Jack on the bonnet. In the spring of 1939, an emplacement was dug for an anti-aircraft battery near the cricket pitch adjacent to our flat. I had no sense that what was happening in Europe had anything to do with me. I don't remember looking at pre-war English newspapers. Unlike the New York Times, they had no fat Sunday editions with coloured pages of funnies in the middle. There was no English Dick Tracy, no Little Orphan Annie, not that I liked her, no Alley-oop, no Mutton Jeff. From what I remember, 1939 England had the Lambeth Walk, oi, and that was about it. Sometime in the late summer, my father informed me that he'd been asked by Shell to remain in England to help make sure that Britain had enough oil to win the imminent war. When I said I wanted to go home to America, he said, "Well, if we stay here, at least you can grow up to be an English gentleman, not an American Jew." It wasn't all that attractive a deal, but what choice did I have? My first English school in a big, raspberry-coloured stone mansion halfway up Putney Hill was called Leinster House. I made friends with a boy called Martin Harris, which he pronounced Aris. One day I took him to our flat to show him my dinky toys. Martin's accent sounded no more unusual to me than my Aunt Minnie's, but it alarmed my parents. I was told that Martin was not the sort of boy I ought to be friends with. Funny place, little old England. My school uniform included a blazer and a cap, blue with red piping. One day, near Tibbetts Corner, my mother was driving me to school in the blue standard when we halted at what I knew as a stoplight. A large black limousine drew up next to us. It flew a royal standard alongside its bonnet, which I still called its hood. In it was an upright lady wearing an off-duty tiara. Irene recognised her as being Queen Mary. Mummy whispered, "Take off your cap," which I did, with enough of a flourish to procure a benedictory lift of the left hand from the royal personage. In the late summer of 1939, my parents discussed whether Irene and I should take ship for the States. Although I had no say in the matter, it was my last chance to be a 100% Yank. Instead, soon after my 8th birthday, we went to stay in the country house of the by-then-famous surgeon, Teddy Schlesinger. We listened on the grass tennis court to Neville Chamberlain's dispirited declaration of war, on a portable radio, itself a symptom of the surgeon's success. 2 weeks later, I was delivered in the dark blue standard with the Union Jack on it to a Sussex boarding school. I was called Raphael, not Freddy. Running for linguistic cover, my tomatoes were soon tomatoes. I played soccer in French and English, and as the German panzers broke through in the Ardennes, I was made to bat right-handed when playing cricket rather than left. England, I learned, was a place of dichotomies. One was either Oxford or Cambridge. Eton or Winchester, Arsenal or Chelsea, Surrey or Middlesex, AA or RAC, Austin or Alvis. The Wright mothers shopped at Harrods, sometimes at Derry and Tom's, rarely at Barker's, and never at Ponting's. Some English people had names that were double-barrelled, which were held rather grand. Among my schoolfellows were Odling Smee, Rice Edwards, Upfill Brown, and Points Wright. His points was spelt with a Y and a Z, never again a Z. I soon became the human equivalent of reproduction furniture. I started to learn Latin and became patriotic. We had a large war map with flags denoting the disposition of British, French and German forces. Until May 1940, there was little call to advance or retreat any of them. Then the map was removed from the wall. Not long afterwards, so were we, from Sussex to North Devon. While millions fought and died, I learnt Mensa, Mensa, Mensam, and Amo, Amas, Amat, and Ut, with the subjunctive, which meant in order to. When I was 11, I was introduced to Greek with Luo, Luais, Luai. I loose, you loose, he looses. And the Greek curiosity whereby two gammas in a row were pronounced as if the first of them was an N, as in angelos. If you wanted to go up in the English world, you had to know your irregular verbs. In 1942, the Yanks arrived in North Devon and marched past our school windows. Their accents were no longer mine. After VE Day, my father was offered a job back in the US. I had become a good enough student of dead languages for my parents to decide that it would be unfair on me to have to return to New York. I took a scholarship to Charterhouse and went even deeper into the English way of life. I learnt more Latin and more Greek and was inculcated with the gradations of privilege and punishment, pride and prejudice, which made England what it was and hoped still to be. On Tuesday afternoons we paraded in khaki with boots and gaiters and Lee Enfield rifles and rehearsed what we expected to have to do for king and country. I was never so British as when licensed to carry a swagger stick and wear a Sam Brown belt. In the summer of 1949, my mother and I sailed, once again on the Queen Mary, to visit her father and mother, Max and Fanny, who had reunited to open a deli in Kansas City. I was taken to a cousin's clothing shop and given a pair of American pants, with a zip already, instead of fly buttons. I had dates with local girls who proved a lot keener to kiss than any English girls I'd met. One Missouri parent asked me where I got my funny accent from. I said, guess. She said, St. Joe? St. Joe was 20 miles from Kansas City. Back in New York City, I fell in love with a no longer little girl I used to play with in Central Park, back when I still said things were swell. Mary Jane and I went to see Noel Coward in The Scoundrel. I didn't see a whole lot of the movie. We went on to Waffles at midnight and more necking till 3 in the morning. My mother and I sailed for Southampton on the day that Sir Stafford Cripps devalued the pound. Despite my zip-fronted American pants and my hot American love, I was now too British not to feel the humiliation.